Welcome to Stand to Reason. You might be hearing a voice you don't often hear here. This is Jay Warner Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel here, hoping to give you something to think about in your Christian walk and your Christian worldview. And I'm looking forward to taking your phone calls this hour. Next hour, we're going to have a guest come in and join me, somebody I think you know, certainly somebody who I know real well. And we're going to talk about, you know, the importance of passing on what we believe and what we know is true, evidentially, to the next generation. So what I want to do before I start taking phone calls today is just tell you a little bit, just talk a little bit about some of the challenges. And if you're a parent listening to this, or somebody is like, I'm not really, you know, I don't have kids that age anymore. And well, I don't either. My kids are grown. But I do recognize my responsibility as a parent, a Christian parent, even though I'm not parenting my, you know, teenage kids anymore, or my elementary age kids anymore. I'm in the same family that you're in. We're in this family together called the Christian family, and I bet as you go to your church, you've noticed that there are these annoying things running around called young people. And those are our young people, our kids. Even though they may not be my biological kids, they are my kids in the faith, just as they are yours. And I think that for most of us, we recognize a responsibility. I want to help people who are raising their kids who are younger than me. I've got grandkids coming, I hope, someday, and when that happens, I'll be in a whole other generation of raising up young people and passing along the truth claims of Christianity to them. But you might also be somebody who's working in a youth ministry, or you are a Christian educator, or you're pastoring young people, and you're interested in why Christianity is true, and you listen to Greg every week in order to learn more about that. And if that's the case, I want to pass along to you as part of our first hour together a few tips that might help you teach, might help you pass on truth claims to the next generation, to a generation that we are calling Generation Z or iGen or Next Gen. We're talking about those young people who are probably, say, 3 to 20, who are, if you've got high schoolers or junior hires right now or elementary age kids that you're raising kids, young people, who fall into this demographic we are now calling Gen Z. And if you think about that, that can be rather intimidating, right? I mean, if you're like me, there are times when you have probably struggled to communicate the truth of Christianity to someone who is younger than you. And if you've got teenagers or pre-teenagers, you know this could be challenging. I've talked to Greg about this, right? I mean, Greg often has said on the air that it's a challenge to teach high schoolers. He doesn't often look forward to it. He feels sometimes like he's teaching a collection of paintings, you know, or you might see this. You might feel like you feel like Greg or like others. You're not alone in feeling that way. I think even those of us who we feel like we are, you know, equipped to understand what it is that Christianity claims. You might be somebody, for example, who's read all of Greg's books, and you've even read my books, and you are somebody who keeps up with all the Christian apologetics material that's out there, but you still might struggle to transfer that information, to transfer the knowledge and passion you have to your kids or to younger people who aren't your kids. Look, I've talked to so many parents following events at Rethink conferences, for example, that we do here at Stand to Reason. And we talk a lot about our roles, right? If you're raising the next generation of believers, everyone's a parent. It turns out, even if you aren't a parent yet, if you are part of the Christian family in which young people are present, and that's all of us. And there's a challenge in teaching and training young Christians. So whenever I'm asked, you know, do you have any tips for me? I'm leading a small group of young people. I've got two kids that seem to be kind of dispassionate about Christianity or not always interested. Do you have any tips that will help me to communicate Christian truth to young people? I try to give a few that I will summarize for you in the first few minutes of this hour before we start taking calls. Let me give you a few things that I try to focus on. First thing, I try to be persistent. What I mean is, if you are leading young people, even your own kids, don't be afraid to revisit some of the classic biblical issues and topics and questions and claims repeatedly. Now, this is especially true if you're a youth pastor or a Christian educator, but it's also true if you're a parent. You have a tendency to think, well, we've already had that conversation. But I think you know, if you're leading young people, that one time around the block on that issue is not going to be enough. And because you talked about it a year ago does not mean you ought to talk about it again. You know, I've been a police officer and a detective for many years. And for the 25 years I was on the job, all of those years were filled with training. You have to do this in order to stay certified in California. You have to have certain days in your calendar, in your deployment period, that are dedicated to simply training. Those are training days. Now, every time I went to a training day, I will tell you, most of it, I mean, nearly all of it, very little of it was new. It was all stuff that I had done 1,000 times or had talked about 1,000 different ways. Or, you know, I'm back in driver's training again every 2 years. Look, it's not like I've been in that same driver's training thing 10 times. There's nothing new there. Instead, it usually involves scenarios and skill sets that I've been employing for my entire career, okay? And I had practiced repeatedly until my responses, guess what, were simply a matter of muscle memory. Yet here I am, back in another training day, same training day, doing it all over again. That's why we do it. We do it until these things are ingrained and they become muscle memory. Now, in a similar way, I think all of us as parents, if we're raising up young people or you're leading young people, don't assume that one spiritual discussion, one lecture you might give or a sermon if you're leading young people, that's enough to ingrain that truth into the minds of your group. It's not. Revisit theological, apologetic, and even like behavioral stuff, moral truth claims that are made by Christianity. Revisit those topics repeatedly. Be persistent. Second thing, I try to be humble. I think you know from if you read apologetics books or listen to podcasts that it's commonly seen, I see it, that people who begin to explore and even begin to master evidence for Christianity or master theological claims or master the evidence for God's existence, we sometimes struggle with humility. As you know stuff, knowledge can puff up. And I think even as Christian apologists, right, I wrestle with that. I have to really consciously strive to remember that just because you might know a little more than someone does not make you superior. In fact, there's always going to be someone who knows a lot more than I do. That's always the case, right? So I mean, I think young people see that immediately. And because they are bombarded by information online, they can see a spectrum of knowledge online and they see where you fit in that spectrum. So I think it's important for us to express what I would call appropriate humility, especially to young people who may have already read past what it is you're about to explain to them because they're online and they are bombarded by information. They're going to identify your humility as, I think, a sign of transparency, and that is something that Gen Zers admire. So be humble. Also be understated. Be persistent, be humble, and be understated. I think one important expression of humility, our humility, involves the way that we make the case, not just what we believe, but the way we make it. If there's one thing I've learned in my experiences working in criminal trials, in courtrooms, it's the danger of overstating a case to a jury. I don't want to do that because if I do that, trust me, the defense team will make a point of it. Every case has strengths, and every case has weaknesses. Even cases that I know are true cases that I'm going to make in front of a jury, there are weaknesses. I try to be careful not to overstate what the evidence will demonstrate. And I think we have to be incredibly honest about that with the young people we're training. We cannot overstate the case for Christianity or overstate the case for God. I remember when I wrote Cold Case, I wanted to be as direct as I could and as brief as I could. It was the first book they were allowing me to write. When I got to God's crime scene, I tried to cover every alternative explanation for the 8 pieces of evidence that I see in the universe that I believe most reasonably infer the existence of God. I knew that there were other ways to explain that evidence, and I didn't want to overstate the case for theism. I wanted to give the other perspectives on those other pieces. So I had an entire section of that book which was just stating the case as others would give it who aren't theists. I knew I had to be careful not to overstate what was true in the evidence. So I think that's, you know, we don't want to overstate the case for Christianity or God's existence, and we don't understate the opposition's case either. Because if you do that, if you try to create straw men for your young people and knock them down easily in front of them, they will eventually discover you were creating the straw man. So if you do that, you're only set your students up for even greater challenges when they discover the true extent of the evidence. So be understated. Let me give you another tip when it comes to teaching young people. Be immensely practical. So here we are. We've talked about being persistent and being humble and being understated. Now be practical. I think secularism is so deep-seated in culture that students often don't make natural connections from their beliefs to their behavior. I think that's why it's important to regularly help them see how theology ends up impacting the way we live, how theology shapes practice. So as a youth pastor, I would occasionally role play or ask students to role play, maybe as somebody who is tempting others towards some inappropriate, unchristian behavior. You know, what should we do? How should we respond to that kind of a temptation? What should we say? You know, how should we respond if we fall into such behavior? Role-playing actually helped my young people prepare for temptations before they ever even occurred. But in addition to that, whenever we teach a theological topic to students, to either your kids or the students you're leading, I would always ask, why does this truth matter? How does it relate to our lives? In other words, so what? Now, young people actually want us to ask that question and answer it. Why should I care? So I want to make sure I ask that question and help students draw practical connections, practical conclusions, ways that they can see that theological truths actually impact their daily lives and the way they live, and even some of the things they see on the part of others who are living differently. Okay, so we talked about being persistent, rather humble, understated, practical. Let me give you another tip that I think will help you, and that's to be incredibly personal and contextual. In other words, if you've been teaching young people or training young people or trying to have conversations with your own kids, I think it's easy to want to get some help. You know, is there something out there that could help me structure these conversations? Is there, you know, wouldn't it be great if there was just some book or some curriculum that I could just plug and play? How many times do you hear, do you have anything? And I get this question a lot. Do you have anything I can kind of plug and play? I could just get that would help me have these conversations with my kids or help me have these conversations with my students. Well, okay. When people ask me that, is there some form of existing curriculum out there? I always answer yes and no, because, you know, as teachers and as parents and as pastors, I have scoured the internet in the past. When I was first a youth pastor, I didn't want to have to recreate the wheel. I was hoping there was something out there I could plug and play. I looked all through the marketplace looking for curriculum, and or just looking for ideas, really, on how to train up my young people. Now, in the end, I will tell you that I couldn't find anything that would work in the context of my situation with the young people that I knew I was leading. So I ended up creating curriculum for a number of years that I posted at pleaseconvinceme.com. And that stayed in that position for a number of years until finally I was so embarrassed of it because it was pretty early on in my journey as a pastor. Now, there's stuff out there. You could find some stuff out there. I've created a bunch of stuff for kids 8 to 12 at Casemakers Academy. All of our books now are all in curriculum. There is small group curriculum for all of my books. But even with those kinds of courses that are designed, right, to be used in that setting, you're going to have to do some modification. It's going to look different for you in how you use curriculum and depending on your situation, depending on your context. So, yeah, we create this curriculum. It's out there. I would start looking for the available curriculum, but also recognize you're going to have to modify it. All that curriculum, anything you find online, any syllabus you might find online, any internet resource you might find online, that is just your starting point. It's not the thing you're eventually probably going to be using in front of your own kids. You're going to be looking at it yourself, shaping it, changing certain things, contextualizing it for your students. You're going to use that material to form and supplement your own material. That's why, in the end, yes, you're going to have to become the best Christian apologist that your kids know. And that means you're going to have to master some of this before. You're not going to be able to use somebody else's mastery all alone. You're going to have to master some of this too, because, by the way, the minute your kids have a question, there's not going to be a recorded answer on the curriculum. They're going to ask you that question. You have to become a dedicated student. You have to take the time to modify all of the stuff that's out there on the marketplace, including curriculum, to meet your specific needs. Let me give you one more final thing that I think is probably more, even more practical or more application. I mean, some of these are broader concepts, right? But I've even with all that in mind, I take this last step, and I almost thought, well, I'd love to write a whole book on just this one topic, and that is, yeah, it's important to be persistent and humble and understated and practical and personal and contextual, but it's really important to be visual. I think that Gen Z, this generation, this is the first generation people describe as digital natives. And we'll talk more about this in the next hour. But that digital native description really means they are visual natives, because the thing that's driving the digital revolution of phones at the end of their arm is not just access to information. It's access to video. You know, you and I, if you're my age, if you're going to search for something, your search engine of choice is probably Google or something like that. For Gen Z, the search engine of choice is YouTube, to ask the same questions you're asking of Google, because they are visually oriented. They don't want to read an article about it. They want to see the video. And the video better be short and concise and to the point. Doesn't have to be, by the way, super flashy and animated and all of that. That we think as boomers and as Gen X and as millennials maybe even, that that needs to be the case. But what I've seen is, if you can just be genuine and the video is brief and it's powerful, just that's enough. This generation, and by the way, this is the generation that will outnumber all other generations demographically as boomers die. The next baby boom is not Gen X, it's not millennials, it's Gen Z. And they are incredibly visual. And I think that's probably been true of millennials too, right? Because they also inherited, they were digital immigrants to this technology. But I think years ago, I knew this, working with young people in a high school ministry. And so I started to change the way I would speak to them. And I called this language visualish. And what I mean is, I wasn't just writing sermons and then trying to find ways to find images for the sermons I was writing. I learned to write with images. In other words, to think of how can I communicate this visually? And then I'll find words for it later to write on paper. But rather than composing a message on paper and then finding images, I started to think visually from the very beginning. What word picture? What visual sequence will help me to explain this concept? What visual metaphor has the power to speak 1,000 words on this issue? What object lesson can I use to make the case? So I would suggest, if you have young people in your sights and you want to help them, start speaking visualish as you use images and props and video to communicate your message. As a matter of fact, I'm just starting at the initial stages of writing another book. And rather than write the book in Word, I am writing the book in Photoshop and PowerPoint and creating visual sequences. Now, at the end, I will turn those visual sequences into words for a book. But it's driven by visual language, because I think in the end, as you're communicating these ideas to people, I'm going to be speaking to young people and using the same visual media that I'm creating right now. I also have discovered a long time ago that if you write the book first and then create the visual presentations, I find as I'm creating the visual presentations, I'm thinking to myself, why didn't I think of this when I was writing the book? There's a better way to communicate this concept. And I discovered it trying to make the thing visual. So rather than discover that later, I've learned to write books visually first. And then that's why you'll see a lot of illustrations in my books, though, because I'm just trying to communicate back to you in the book what started off as a visual concept to begin with. Young people, I think, are incredibly visual. I will tell you, I hear this all the time. If you can make your presentations visual, what you'll discover is when you're after the service is over, I'll have people come to me and say, if you're like my age or older, one lady came and during one presentation and said, "Hey, I want to congratulate you. For the first time, my husband did not fall asleep in church." And I thought, really? It has nothing to do with what I'm saying, probably. It has more to do with keeping it visual. And I also found the same service, the next service, another lady came to me and said, "Hey, I want to congratulate you. For the first time, my kids did not look at their phone." Well, that sounds like crazy, right? But that really should be our goal. Can I communicate this? And there's a part of me that says, really, I shouldn't have to do that. Is it God's word? Of course, yes. Of course, I'm not minimizing the importance of biblical teaching, But what does Jesus do? He offers word pictures, parables, stories that I'm sure as he was speaking these stories, people began in their minds to visualize the narrative that he was describing in the parable, which is a word picture. That's what I'm suggesting we do here, is try to help people with word pictures that actually end up becoming picture pictures. We're thinking visually from the beginning. Anyway, I hope that kind of helps you as you think through how to communicate to young people. Be persistent, be humble, be understated, be practical, be personal and contextual, and finally, be visual. I talk about this a lot more in our book, So the Next Generation Will Know, and we'll be talking about that next hour with my co-author, Sean McDowell. What we're going to do now, though, is we'll take a break, and then we'll come back, and I'll start answering your phone calls. So be sure, if you are outside the USA, rather, that is 562-424-8229. If you're inside the country, of course, it's 855-243-9975. Give us a call. I'll be answering questions right after the break.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
Have you ever wondered how Stand to Reason is able to produce fresh, accessible, and relevant content each week? As a nonprofit ministry, we rely on generous supporters in order to provide the tools and tactics you need to be an effective ambassador for Christ. If you've benefited from this podcast or any of our donor-provided resources, including apps, blog posts, articles, or short videos, consider making a financial contribution to Stand to Reason today. When you visit str.org/donate, you'll find a newly renovated transaction page that makes it easier than ever to show your financial support. It has been an honor providing you with a host of free resources over the past 25 years to help you give voice to the Christian worldview. Please help us to continue on into the next 25 years by making a gift today at str.org/donate.
Welcome back to Stand to Reason. Jay Warner Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel, answering your questions. A lot of questions coming in. Thanks so much for calling in. You know, it's interesting when you do a show like this, there's a culture here at Stand to Reason. I think that Greg has done an amazing job catechizing us, right? We listen to Greg every week, and we end up knowing a lot about stuff that then I always think when I come in, how can I come in and not say something that Greg has already said 100 times? So we will try to do our best with that. Okay, we're going to start with line one here, which is Andre from North Carolina, I believe. Hey, Andre, how are you doing?
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing good. Glad you called.
Okay, awesome. I just had a quick question about the falsifiable nature of Christianity, and if
yes.
I could just give you a really quick background.
Sure, go ahead.
On Frank Turek's podcast a couple of weeks ago, Elisa Childers filled in, and I was able to hear the story of how she became involved with apologetics for the second time,
yes.
In which basically a former pastor had some doubts, and he used a class to express those doubts, and then through that, you know, she began to wonder what the answers to the questions that her pastor had was, and then she found apologetics, and she said it really maybe saved her faith. I don't want to misquote her if she didn't say that, but
sure.
It helped out.
Sure.
And so for me, I kind of grew up in a charismatic, just so answers church style background. But you know, when I went to college, I faced a lot of these things too. But for me, I just felt like my anecdotal experience with Christianity was a little bit bigger than the questions that people were posing. And I know that's not the case for everyone. I understand that lots of you know, students leave the faith in college because of these issues. But I just wanted to know, if there were a discovery or like a series of historical discoveries that seemed to ostensibly disprove Christianity, how you would approach that or where you would go with it?
Okay, well, I always wonder when this question is asked, you know, like what would the nature of those discoveries be, right? I mean, you could say, well, if you found the body of Jesus, how would we ever know that's the body of Jesus? I mean, I've seen, for example, the Talpiot tomb, right, where they're arguing that they've got a tomb that allegedly contains, it's the family of Jesus. But you have to make that case, and I've seen how they make that case, and it's not very compelling. And so I always wonder, but I get it, just as a hypothetical, that the real question is, if we could somehow, there was some definitive piece of evidence that demonstrated that Christianity was not true, how would we respond? So the question I have for you is look, if I'm asking others to be open to whether or not, if the evidence was compelling enough, would you believe? And we ask that question sometimes. Frank Turk and I have started asking that question. I only started because of Frank, because it was such a powerful question. If Christianity were true, would you become a believer? And we ask that question sometimes as an opening strategy when we're talking to people who are skeptical, right? Because we want to know if Christianity was not true. Well, I'm just saying as a hypothetical, if you could demonstrate that if Christianity was true, would you become a Christian? And a lot of people will say to us, well, no. I still wouldn't become a Christian. That at least tells us, okay, we know what we're up against. It's not about whether or not it's an evidentially strong case. It's really about a condition of the heart. That's a whole other issue. And so we will often ask that question. If Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? You're asking the converse question. If Christianity wasn't true, would you still be a Christian? So let me ask that question of you just directly, Andre. If Christianity isn't true, would you still be a Christian?
Well, no. If it wasn't true, I don't think I would.
Yeah, I'm in the same position you are. I don't know why anyone would adopt and reorder their lives based on a worldview that they knew was no longer true. So now again, how we get to that, whether or not it's true, that's another issue. But I think if Christianity were not true, I would not be a Christian. And I'm not sure that's really all that controversial to make that kind of a claim, right? I think what would be more controversial would be, what would you think would be the evidence that would, and that's really where the conversation lies. What evidence do you think would ultimately say that it's not true, or ultimately demonstrate that it's not true? That's where the debate lies, right? But in the end, if we could just take it as an abstract, if Christianity is not true, would you still be a Christian? Well, no, I wouldn't. And I often say this, you know, if you've heard my story, I'm not somebody who was raised in the church. I'm not a Christian because I was trying to fix my life, and I'm a Christian because it's true. And once I recognized it was true, and even more importantly, what it said about me was true, well, then I didn't have a choice. If you have a high regard for truth, then now you're stuck, right? So let me ask you, Andre, sometimes when people ask this question, what they're really asking is about the level of subjective versus objective experience, you know, or evidence. So is that in some ways embedded in your question? Like, in other words, go ahead.
Well, I could also see, you know, certain strong historical or archaeological things being part of the package with, you know, other arguments for Christianity, moral and cosmological and things like that. So it's not necessarily a set of subject. I guess you could frame it that way and give an answer. That's fine.
Well, I guess okay, so. Part of it for me is I get this question, and maybe this is not yours, but when I'm asked this question on occasion, it really comes down to you've had an experience too, right? We all have. We have experiences as Christians that we now interpret as being from God. Or confirming for us in some way a truth about Christianity, and so the question then becomes: well, where does that role of your own? You could say I'm an eyewitness. I've had an experience that I witnessed that it contributes to the case for why I believe this is true. And so then what do you do with your own experiences if at some point it was demonstrated that it wasn't true? And for me, I always evaluate that and say, well, you know, I have that entire rich, robust family, extended family of six brothers and sisters who are raised LDS, who all would say that they have had experiences that demonstrated that that was true. So I think we can have experiences, and that is part of our response to God and our evaluation of whether God exists, but we have to measure those experiences against the evidence that's not dependent on our experience, that objectively exists for us, right? So So that's part of the equation. But I think for me, to answer the question more directly, it really comes down to would anybody believe something or stay in that camp of those who believe something if it was demonstrated that it's not true? And I think most of us would uncontroversially say no.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate your phone call.
No problem. Thank you.
Thanks, Andre. Let me go to line three. This is Daryl. Daryl, how are you, sir? No, I'm sorry. I'm in line two. I'm going to put you back on hold. Hang on. Now, you know what? This is the rookie at work. Daryl, how are you? I'm on line three now. How are you, bud?
I'm doing great. How are you?
And Tim's on line two. I'll come back to you, Tim. Trust me. I'm not ignoring you. So I'll come back to you. You know what they did to me, Daryl? They put the sequence up in an order that's different on the phone just to mess with me. Do you believe that? That's all Amy and Brooke doing that on purpose. I know you did that on purpose. Okay. So now let's go to your question.
Good.
Thanks, brother. Appreciate you waiting for me. Go ahead.
My question centers around the manuscript evidence for the reliability of the Bible.
Okay.
So basically I've read from many authors that the sheer number of manuscript copies we have allows us to have a really good trust that, you know, we're reading authentic original scriptures. But my question centers on how do we account for, like, the original copies of those manuscripts? So, like, if the first couple of manuscripts or copies of the manuscripts were, like, messed up in some sort of way, and then other people kept on copying those originally messed up copies, then over time, like, you never really get to the original, right? And so you may have a huge number of copies, but if the first ones were, you know, flawed in different areas, how do we view the manuscript evidence for the reliability of the Bible in light of that possibility?
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that, actually. So let me just, you know, we just did an episode of STR Ask with Amy, and we talked about this idea of my basic nature is to be skeptical anyway. And so when I heard that claim, we have so many manuscript copies of the manuscript, well, that would be helpful if they were all incredibly early. But they aren't all incredibly early. There's a gap before you have a complete New Testament. And it's a pretty dramatic gap in time. Now, it's not dramatic compared to other ancient claims, but I don't care, but compared to other ancient claims, I need to know what happened in the gap. How do I know that we get to the first complete manuscript that we have and there hasn't been corruption in the first complete manuscript we have? If we don't have manuscripts in the first century and we only have scraps of maybe one gospel, and then you have some larger scraps, and then finally by the fourth century you have a complete manuscript, really? That doesn't seem to give me much confidence. Now, let me tell you how I had to reconcile it. This is not unusual working cold cases, that you have a 30-year gap in information, which today it might as well be a 300-year gap because you have a generation lost, right? So you have to kind of overcome this issue and to try to get back to what actually happened then. So here's what I would say. And I've heard apologists say this. They'll say, hey, we could reconstruct the entire New Testament. There used to be a claim out there that we could reconstruct the entire New Testament short of like 11 verses just from the writings of church fathers who are quoting from the Gospels. But the problem we have is that the vast majority of church fathers that we're talking about there are also later in history. So they could be quoting something that's been corrupted. Doesn't really help us to know if it's been corrupted. So for me, there's something that I call the chain of custody. And this is what we talk about in criminal trials. If you've got something that you're claiming 50 years later in trial, in a court trial, you're claiming that this piece of evidence, exactly as you're showing it to the jury now, was recovered from the crime scene 50 years ago. Well, how do I know that this thing hasn't been tampered with and changed? If there's some mark on that piece of evidence that's pivotal in the case, how do I know that mark didn't get on there later? That you, as a matter of fact, as a detective, when you pulled it out of property, you didn't put the mark on it. How would I know that that mark was actually at the crime scene on that piece of evidence? Well, what you would do is you would say, who collected that evidence back in 50 years ago? And you'd find out who that was. And you'd ask, did they take a picture of it? You know, back in those days, they take a Polaroid? Or take a 35-millimeter picture? Did they write a report in which they described the condition of this object? And they mentioned the mark that's so important to your case? And then when they gave it to the next guy who brought it to the property room, did they copy that information and also say, yeah, I saw the mark, or took another picture that shows the mark? And then when they brought it to the crime lab, was there somebody there who took a picture there? And then over the years, every time it's handled before it gets to your courtroom, is there one person after another who mentions the mark over the course of years? Those people are like links in a chain that connects the past to the present. And that's why we call this the chain of custody. And for every piece of evidence in a criminal trial, you're going to have to show the chain of custody. Who touched it from then till now, and what did they say about it? And that stuff better match. That stuff better line up. Otherwise, I'm going to think a change occurred at some point in that chain of custody. So what was important for me was, okay, so these eyewitnesses allegedly of Jesus, did they ever give their information to anyone? Who's the first person they gave it to? And you actually know who those folks are because, if, like, for example, John, his students were Ignatius and Polycarp and Papias. And so you actually have people that he told about Jesus. Now, the question is, when he mentioned the story of Jesus, are all the miracles still there? Did he really rise? I mean, are the essential attributes of Jesus present in his communication to the very first people in the chain of custody after the eyewitnesses? And then who did they give it to? Well, two of those people were the students of Irenaeus. And then who did Irenaeus give it to? Well, his student was Hippolytus. I mean, Irenaeus, his teachers were Ignatius and Polycarp, so he's a student of those two. And then Irenaeus is the teacher of Hippolytus. And from teacher to student, you can trace the information related to Jesus to see if it changes over time before you get a complete manuscript. And so for me, it's not a matter of, well, is every line and every story. I need to know, because the things that are the most controversial for me are, okay, did he really rise from the tomb? Is he really born of a virgin? Did he really work those miracles? Is it really all the doctrinal stuff that we would say is creedal, you know, the stuff that we would say is a Christian essential theologically? Is that stuff present at every point? So I would just start with the very first links in the chain, which are going to be Ignatius, who wrote letters. I think we still have seven letters from Ignatius. We don't have any letters of Papias, but we have one letter of Polycarp to the Philippian church. And in these letters, which are not part of your scripture, but they're just ancient documents, you can see what it is that John taught them. And I would expect the story of Jesus to match what we have today. And guess what? It matches. So now can I say that I can reconstruct the entire New Testament verse by verse? No, I can't say that. But if you're wondering if they've been lying to us or adding certain essentials about Jesus in the years before you finally do have an ancient manuscript, that claim you can investigate, and that's just simply not true. So I wrote about this in one chapter of Cold Case Christianity, just to talk about how do we know that there hasn't been evidence tampering. And this is how we test it in criminal trials. And by the way, every good defense attorney is going to demand the entire chain of custody. And if by chance, because of poor record keeping, you've got a gap in your chain of custody, he is going to exploit it. But here's what matters. Does the first link match the last link? Even if you're missing links in between, you know the story hasn't changed. And it turns out the first links, which are Ignatius and Polycarp, for example, in the writings of Paul, he had two students, Clement and Linus. He mentions both of those in his letters. But Clement became a bishop, both of them became bishops in Rome. But Clement wrote letters, and at least the first letter we know is authentic, First Clement. You can see if Paul's description of Jesus is the same when Clement repeats it in his, or has it been changed? So at least we would have to say that more accurate to say, or it's far more reasonable to say, and I don't think it's reasonable, but I mean, at least you could say, well, it must be a lie on the part of John than it would be to say it must have been changed over time, because we know he's telling that story to the very first set of students he has. So if you want to claim it's a lie, okay, we can talk about that. But to claim that it's been changed over time, that is simply, I don't think, reasonable to assert. So that's how I look at it. And I'm not inclined to say we can reconstruct. I've done some work on that. You cannot reconstruct the entire New Testament with the church fathers. And even if you could, it would not be evidentially valuable unless you were doing it with the very earliest church fathers. So to pick a church father and say, well, yeah, he quotes a lot of the New Testament, but he's in the fourth century, who cares? The question is, what would have been available for him to quote in the first and second century? That's what we all want to know, okay? So a church father from the fourth century doesn't really help me with that. But anyway, so for me, once I did that, I felt very comfortable that we had good information that had been transmitted faithfully. Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. It was a really good answer, too. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Could you also say that, you know, perhaps the, I don't know how exactly how the transmission worked, but could you also say, like, the originals themselves were, like, given to different churches, different areas, and they made their manuscripts of it, and then you just compare the manuscripts that came out of different locations?
Yeah,
which both use originals?
Yes, I think geography helps us. Here's why I say that, because if you take a chain of custody, and I talk about this in that chapter of Cold Case, you can actually develop chains of custody, more than one. I think there's good reason to believe that Mark is sitting at the feet of Peter, and when he is listening to Peter's stories and developing the Gospel of Mark. I think there's good, that's a whole other argument, you make that a different way. But if that is true, then we can trace Peter's gospel of Mark, through Mark, who ends up transmitting that chain of custody in the North African church. And you can trace that. I trace that in the book. You can trace the work of Paul through Rome, and you can trace the work of John through Asia Minor. So now you have three different places in the kingdom where this transmission of documents and ideas and concepts about Jesus are taking place. And interestingly, they all match, which I think is helpful. Not to say that there was no way to communicate this in Rome and the empire in the first century, but you would have to admit it was much more difficult to communicate detailed information. And the way it's been transmitted, it's clear that there's no modification of the story in those three separate regions. So I think you're just stuck with the idea that I think it's early, and I think it's unchanged over time. That in itself, though, does not mean it's true. It just means that it passes the test, two of the four tests that I would apply to any eyewitness. So again, I'm looking for, you know, is it early enough to have actually been an eyewitness account? Has it been changed over time? Has it been influenced by bias or false motive? And finally, does it have any touchpoint corroboration that could help us determine if it's true? So those are the four areas that I would assess an eyewitness, and I think you could do that with the Gospels. Anyway, I hope that helps you, Daryl.
Definitely does.
All right, brother, I'm going to let you go and go to the next phone call. We're not even going to take a break here, if that's okay with you guys, because I'm going to try to get all of you guys in on these questions before we go to our guest in the next hour. I'm going to go to line two now, which is Tim. Tim, how are you, brother? Sorry I had to make you wait.
Oh, I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for calling.
Oh, I had a question. I have a 9-year-old son, and he goes to Christian school, and a couple of his Christian buddies got baptized. And he says, well, I want to get baptized. And I don't want him to just do it because his friends do it. I want him to have the right reason, but I'm having difficulty putting that into words.
Yeah, I know.
Could you help me out?
Yeah, that same thing with us, right? I was youth pastoring. I was in a high school setting, high school ministry. I was doing junior hires and high schoolers. And I had, my kids were still young. I had maybe one junior hire, but I had upper elementary. My second son, my daughters were like lower elementary or like, you know, like kindergarten, okay, when I first started. Mm. So they're watching us baptize high schoolers, you know, for four mm-hmm. years. And they're like, hey, I want to do it. And so the first question I have to ask is, okay, so why do you want to be baptized?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that's super important. I think also a church that that really explains. And we even had a class that you would have to take for baptism to make sure that you actually understood what it was a process. So it wasn't just, hey, I want to hop in the water today. We would have walked them through a process that we had already established as a ministry that would help us to clarify why anyone would do such a thing. But I think the first thing we ask our kids is, why do you want to do it? And of course, you'd want to hear something that would articulate the reason why historically people have wanted to be baptized instead of, well, you know, Ryan's doing it, you know, well, I just got to watch two of my friends do it. And I know as much as they know. I mean, the issue really comes down to, now here's the trickier thing, I think, though, as a parent, is how do you I think we are hesitant to throw water on any fire that might be brewing in our kids toward God, right? Like
right.
What I don't want to do, there's a side of me that says, this is great that he wants to be baptized, that he sees this as a positive, that he sees this as something that is attractive in his own mind.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a side of me that says, yeah, but that ought not be the reason why you would want to do it to begin with.
Yeah.
Make sure I don't extinguish? And so I think what I would do is I would hold it out as a goal that is still ahead of him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might say, hey, all my friends have cell phones and I really want a cell phone. Well, someday you're going to have one. But
yeah.
It's not the right time yet. You know,
and how do you know when it is? How do you know when it is the right time?
Well, I think it really comes down to whether or not. So why? Let's just back it up for a second. If I told you as a stranger that I went to church with you once and I wanted to be baptized, and you asked me, well, why do you want to be baptized? What do you think you should hear from me that would give you confidence that I even understand what baptism is?
I don't know if I could answer that.
Yeah. So for me, it would be, well, I think this is the outward expression of an inner decision that I have made for Christ, that I feel that I need to stand up now for what I know to be true.
Mm.
And that is why I want to get in that water to not because I think it's going to do any magical thing for me or that
right.
it's going to jump me into a group with my friends who already seem to be in the group, that instead that it's an outward expression of an inward commitment that I want to do publicly. And for the reason not to join that clique of friends, but to be identified now. So it would be a matter of really wanting to know what is the gospel and do our young people know what the gospel is, right? It's not membership in this club we call Christianity. It's really an understanding of the nature of humans and our identity as one of the fallen humans that needs a savior. And until I knew that bad news, there was no good news available to me. I needed to know first. This is why there was a season there when I was, I would say I had belief that, because I had investigated the Gospels and I came away from that saying, these are true. They are telling me something I can trust. I don't get it, though. Why would God have to come and die on a cross? Even though I could say, I think there's good reason to believe all that stuff happened, I didn't yet understand why it had to happen. And that's because I hadn't yet really examined the Gospels and the New Testament clearly for what it said about me instead of what it said about Jesus. In other words, I didn't know my problem.
Yeah.
I knew it intuitively, but I didn't get the robust Christian description of it. And then once I read it, I was like, oh my gosh, this is describing me perfectly. And then I recognized my need for a savior. I don't know that young people get that to that point.
Exactly. Especially a 9-year-old.
Yeah, no, listen, this is why I think that there is an approach. And I don't think that's the same age for every student, for every kid. Every kid comes to that a little bit differently, right? Because they may have an understanding.
Right.
So, you know, for example, I did try to give my kids a little bit of credit for the fact that they had heard the gospel and heard me explain this a bazillion times. But even having heard me explain it a bazillion times does not mean they understand the content of the words. They could have even repeated a gospel presentation. It did not mean they understood it.
Right.
Right? Because they may not understand what these terms mean. So I really had to kind of unpack it using language. And so even if my kids were able to say, well, and they were able to walk down the Romans road, I would have to back it up and say, well, what do you mean by that? And what do you mean by that? Because I think they could repeat something without even understanding it. So,
yeah, sure.
And that's why, you know, listen, this is a lot of us as parents, we're like, hey, if my kid wants to be baptized, I'm just going to trust that he's talked it over with the youth pastor and off we go. We're going to do it. Right. But the reality is this takes a little more guidance for us as parents to have to actually have those kinds of conversations with our kids. And those, I think, are a lot harder. They require us to know something. And they require us to maybe have to say no right now, you know, not yet.
Mm-hmm.
That's coming for you. And I can see you're close. And, you know, if you want to have a deeper conversation about it, but I don't want him to think I'll say whatever dad needs to hear so I can have impress my friends. So that's
a good point.
That's the trick, right? So, but I think it's like anything else that we think is good for our kids that we are going to let them have at some point. But first we want them, we don't let them drive. you know, at 10, they might even be big enough and physically capable to drive, but there's some things we say, hey, it's not quite, not quite yet. And so for me anyway, because I think that this is something we do in response to something God does, that I'm less inclined. I mean, I want to at least know, does this child even know what it is he wants to do? And so I was just asking, you know, those questions we ask. Yeah.
Well, so do you have any resources that I could look at that might help me to train him and guide him?
Well, okay, so this is something. Okay, yeah, this is so tough, right? So a lot of this comes down to I was the kind of person who would always be talking about these things, and so a lot of this was more organic, right? We your kids mm-hmm. learn from you, but even then, I remember having one conversation with one of my kids when they were already in their teenage years and wondering, did I do a very good job? Mm-hmm. I thought I had done a good job of explaining these concepts, but then I began to wonder if I really had or not, right? So I think that there's some soul searching to be done in that. But as far as resources go, what I'm going to do, I'm going to ask Amy and Brooke to take a look right now on our STR resources and see if there's something, and I will talk about it when I come back, if there's an article that might help us about catechizing and kind of training up young kids pre-baptism or kind of prepare them with the Christian essentials. Is that true?
Yes.
You're kind of asking that, right? Like, what is out there
right.
that would prepare our kids with Christian essentials? I know that depending on the age of your kids, 9's a little bit older. You know, we've done work in our Casemakers Academy. It's just at casemakersacademy.com for 8 to 12. But it's really more about evidence for Christianity. Younger kids, for example, William Lane Craig has a great series of books that teaches Christian essentials to younger kids. Melissa Kane Travis has got a great series of books that will teach Christian essentials at a little bit older age group. So I would look for both William Lane Craig
and
Melissa
Kane.
Yeah, those are good, I think.
I have the William Lane Craig ones, but I think they're a little too young for a 9-year-old.
Yes, they are. And I think what you're going to have to do is take those conversations that are described in Bill's books and then contextualize them for 9-year-olds, right? So anyway, just something to think about, okay?
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you so much. Appreciate you. We're going to go one more phone
call.
Have a
good day.
You too. And we're going to Carlton in Dallas. How are you, Carlton? We've got a few minutes here. I'm going to squeeze you in before we take a break.
Oh, I really appreciate it.
No
I'll
problem.
Try to be quick.
Yep, no problem.
So my question, I guess you kind of touched on it with Daryl. I'm speaking to a friend who's just coming out of Islam. He says he believes there's a God, believes Jesus existed, but as far as, you know, him claiming to be God and stuff like that, he's not really that set on. I kind of set forth that he did claim to be God and authenticated this claim to his death and resurrection. He said he would believe that there was good evidence. And so right now the rub I'm having is just making the case for eyewitness testimony, making the case that it's early and, you know, like the lack of the temple destruction, all that stuff is kind of simple and, you know, the transmission is fine. But the jump from that to saying they were eyewitnesses, because his main point is just because they said they were eyewitnesses doesn't necessarily mean that. So,
well, that's true. Okay,
yeah, exactly.
So let me give you a quick strategy on that. I never trust eyewitnesses. I say this all the time. I've just gotten burned by so many times by eyewitnesses who make claims that aren't true. They maybe weren't even there when they made the claim. So I always suggest don't test eyewitnesses. I mean, don't trust eyewitnesses. Test them. If they pass the test, well, then you can move toward trusting them. But you don't just trust them off the top. And I think you already know. You've started to talk about those steps that I take, which are number one: were they really there to see what they said they saw? So how early is the account? Is it early enough to have been written by an eyewitness and to have been written in front of others who would know if they're lying? Number two, can it be corroborated in some small way? Three, has it been honest and accurate over time, or has that story changed? And four, do they have a bias that would cause them to lie? So I think that's one way to evaluate them. But the bigger problem I have, it seems, is just getting people to see the Gospels as eyewitness accounts. I mean, they seem like they're some genre of literature, but I don't believe they're eyewitness accounts. I hear people say that all the time. So let me give you a way, and all of these 4 points I'm going to give you have the letters A and S in them. I've only got 3 minutes. I'm just going to blow right through them. Here's the first one.
All right.
Attributed statements. Remember that the New Testament authors, they always refer to themselves as eyewitnesses. And that language, I think, presumes the author has something that he is describing. For example, in the last chapter of John's Gospel, right, what does he say? He says that he's testifying and that his testimony is true. You see in 1 John and 2 Peter, you see that they identify themselves as eyewitnesses. So it appears that the authors are identifying themselves as somebody who saw something that they're trying to communicate. They even say that we're not inventing clever stories, right? 1 John 1, 2 Peter 1:16, even Luke clearly says, I'm not an eyewitness, but right. I'm talking to those who were. So right. they're trying to communicate these. That's number one, attributed statements. Two, the apostolic strategy, AS again, that's consistent with the way that the authors behaved a certain way in the book of Acts. It's a strategy they used. It was always the same. They identified themselves as eyewitnesses who saw the resurrection. That was their consistent apostolic strategy. When they chose to share something, they didn't just, have a pat answer. No, they actually identified themselves as eyewitnesses. It was their status. Let me give you a third thing. Ancient support, another AS. The earliest writings of the church fathers will confirm that these folks were eyewitnesses. So Papias, he describes Mark as a record of Peter, okay? According to Papias, Mark was not an eyewitness. It was Peter who was, and Mark is simply... So you have the ancient support of church fathers who are identifying those folks as eyewitnesses. And lastly, I think you have the authoritative selection, AS again. The canon of Scripture reflects the eyewitness nature of the Gospels in so much that one of the criteria to be included in the canon was that it has to be written by somebody who saw Jesus, who knew Jesus. So you have struggled to figure out, well, should Hebrews come in? Who wrote it? I mean, is it written by somebody who saw? This is why Paul consistently says, I also, 1 Corinthians 15, he says, I also, as someone untimely born, saw Jesus. That gives him status. It's the eyewitness status that allows you to write canon of Scripture. So it's those four things I think scream. Number one, they called themselves eyewitnesses. Number two, that was their strategy to represent themselves as eyewitnesses. Number three, the earliest people who knew them identified them as eyewitnesses. And number four, their work got into the canon if and only if they were eyewitnesses. I think there are good reasons to see the Gospels as eyewitness accounts. And that's kind of the loose structure of how I would make that claim and support that evidentially. Now, we are running out of time. So I'm so sorry.
Awesome. Carl, I appreciate you.
Thanks, man. I appreciate you having on the show. We'll take a break. And we come back, my co-author, Sean McDowell, is going to join me and talk about how to raise up the next generation of believers.